It's election season. Can you feel it? Can you feel the electricity in the air? That high that you get from flexing your U.S. citizen muscles when you check that little box with your little pencil? Anybody? Well, come on now. You know, the clock is ticking away toward your big choice. Good evening. You're listening to In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich, here with our studio audience in the UBS Forum in downtown St. Paul. And tonight, we're talking politics, elections, democracy. You know the standard refrain, right? It goes a little something like this.
Elections matter. The choices we make matter. But how to make good choices this election season? Hi, Gary Eichten here. And this
now, that's been running on Minnesota Public Radio, but the sentiment is hardly unique to us. Do your civic duty. Research the qualifications of the candidates for state auditor, all of them. Your vote for governor can make the difference between this guy in a suit and the other guy in a suit. Or maybe the third guy in a suit, but he doesn't really have a chance, so don't worry about that guy. Sure, it is easy, right, to be cynical about democracy. That is not our goal tonight. Our plan is to look behind the cynicism and ask, why? Now, we had an informal get-together earlier this month for listeners to join us and talk about that question. It's fair to say the general attitude about elections was skeptical, but there were a range of takes on the actual act of voting.
I would just perish without being able to vote. I mean, when I come out of that voting booth, I just think it's all I can do to suppress a screech of joy.
Screech of joy. Anybody else screech for joy? Screech for joy is actually here tonight. We're glad to have her in the audience. For some people, voting comes from an obsession with the game and drama of politics.
I'm such a geek. I actually absentee voted in the primaries.
Some folks do turn out to vote, but the act feels somehow a little hollow. Maybe it doesn't really capture how they actually feel about the system.
But we can't vote against people. We could only vote for someone else. What if we could vote against people? Like an anti-vote, and then you average.
So our little conversation went looking for democracy in action. Places in American life where there is major enthusiasm about voting.
Where is democracy working?
American Idol.
In American Idol, of course. We thought about doing the show tonight on American Idol. We could spend a while on why text messaging your preference for Taylor Hicks 24 times is not really a spot-on parallel for choosing our political leaders. But suffice it to say, there are many reasons why voting has lost some of its luster. Voting is the supreme act in a democracy, yet roughly half of eligible citizens don't bother. Tonight, on In the Loop, we'll spend some time with the non-voters rather than the politicos and pundits. We call every election a race, yet incumbents win 98% of the time, and 90% of the elections for congressional seats are considered safe. We'll talk to candidates who are willing to run uphill in those safe districts. We're calling tonight's episode Voting and Its Discontents. The show is not about profiling the hot races or dissecting the issues. You can get lots of that from other places. Instead, we'll be shining our light on those things that crop up in our path, maybe, on the way to the voting booth. As we usually do, we'll take the conversation out to our audience here in the UBS Forum a little later in the show. I know we've got some very interesting perspectives out there, and I'm looking forward to it. We have the Smarts as our house band tonight, providing the music you're hearing behind me. Whether you're with us on the radio, on the web, or here in person, thanks for joining us in the loop. As I mentioned, a number of those voices in our opening came from a gathering that we had at a bar here in St. Paul, actually, for people to just join us and talk about politics and give us some inspiration and ideas for the show that you're going to hear tonight. Before we get into the show, I just want to mention we've got another one of those coming up Thursday, October 26th. It's going to be at Cosmos Bar, which is in the Grave 601 Hotel in downtown Minneapolis. We'll be there 5:30 to 7:30 the next topic is still to be announced, so we'll talk about where we're going next. That's what The Loop is all about. If you want to be notified of that, you can head to our website. Of course, we'll have details up there, but you can sign up for our email list while you are visiting us online. And now, on with the show, Voting and Its Discontents. During election season, you'll hear on the news from passionate voters, dejected voters, undecided voters. You won't hear much from the often silent majority, non-voters. Naturally, they were at the top of our list. So we'll begin tonight with this piece from Sandon Totten on those Americans who are most notable this time of year by their absence.
When you ask, most people will say they plan on voting.
For like the presidential election, I'll probably maybe vote.
But if you press them on the chances of them actually doing it...
1 in 4. Maybe. Depends on if I like get my ass up and actually go.
They'll often admit, chances are slim at best. Stephen is a freshman at the University of Minnesota. He's 19, and he didn't vote last year, and won't be voting this year either. Like most people in this piece, he didn't give his last name because he's embarrassed that he didn't vote. It's surprising, though, since he's hardly alone. Almost two-thirds of Americans old enough to vote didn't turn out for the last midterm elections in 2002. Young people, like Stephen, are the least likely to vote, but his reason could apply to people of any age. Apathy.
I am really not interested in politics at all. I never really follow them. I guess I don't really care enough. Maybe I should.
Like Stephen, Kristen is another new eligible voter, but she won't be hitting the polls either.
I don't know. Sometimes it seems like there's so many people who vote, like one vote, you know, it doesn't really matter.
I think at some level people do recognize that their vote is a drop in the bucket, and they behave in ways that reflect that reality.
Walt Stone teaches political science at the University of California in Davis. He says it's not just young people that think this way. Lots of people do. It's called the paradox of collective action. When a lot of people vote, one individual's vote makes almost no difference. A rational mind calculates the chances of their vote actually affecting the election versus the time it takes to register, go to the polls, wait in line, not to mention the trouble of having to slog through all the slogans and spin just to choose a candidate, and in the end they decide voting doesn't add up. It's rational apathy.
And so it's a fairly narrow economic calculation, but it contains some truth.
Stone points out, if everyone thought this way, then no one would vote, and suddenly one vote would make all the difference. That's the paradox. But enough people do vote so that non-voters don't feel guilty. But apathy isn't the only reason people stay home on election day.
I just don't do it because I think that it doesn't serve the people well. It serves more the wealthy elite.
That's Roger Cummings. He runs a community center for disadvantaged youth. He's well-versed in politics, but he's never voted. He feels the system is broken, and voting won't change that. He didn't always see it that way. Growing up in Cleveland, he thought things would improve for his community when they elected a black mayor, but that didn't happen.
Some of the most horrendous things happened with law enforcement, with the judicial process. I got to see black people have a lot worse time with one of their own people in office, and then I got to see this repeated again and again and again at different stages of my life.
Roger prefers to get directly involved in his community rather than leaving it in the hands of politicians. And if Roger represents the non-voter who feels let down by the system, there's another category that feels ignored by it altogether. A good example are Asian Americans. They have one of the lowest turnouts in the nation, beneath Latino and African American voters. In the Dragon Star Asian Market in St. Paul, Ming says he's registered, but he has more pressing things on his mind than voting.
I don't have time. I'm busy. Yeah, most of the time we have to feed ourselves and our kids. We have to earn money first.
Another shopper, Mai Pa, does vote, but she says many Asian Americans just feel politics don't touch their lives. Sure, they care about big issues like healthcare, for one, but elections come and elections go and not much changes, so they don't vote.
They don't have a reason to, you know, like either party hasn't said, this is what we can do for you and this is why we think you should vote.
Mai admits there are language and cultural barriers, but she puts a lot of the blame on politicians who don't even bother to court the Asian American vote. She says it's their loss, though. As Asian populations continue to grow, politicians are missing out on a huge group of potential voters. This November, the largest political party won't be the Republicans or the Democrats. Like in years past, it'll be the non-voters. And even though they'll be at home November 7th, there's always the chance politicians like Jesse Ventura will come along and tap their political force. In a country where elections are getting more competitive, engaging the no-shows could make all the difference.
That story came from In the Loop's assistant producer, Sandon Totten. Now, can these wayward non-voters be redeemed? Should they be redeemed? Wendy Morris is a member of our Loop network, and in the course of talking about this show, she shared the story of her own transition. We asked her to come tonight and share it with all of you, so please welcome Wendy Morris.
The first time I step inside a voting booth, I may be 4 or 5 years old. My mother and I tuck behind a velvety black curtain. She points. I place my tiny hand on a tiny lever, feeling that satisfying as the lever locks into a decisive downward position. My mother always kept who she voted for a secret. I never knew whether my parents were Democrats or Republicans. Once I could read, my mother stopped taking me with her into the voting booth. I suspect my family's privacy around voting was a reaction to the McCarthy era. A few decades earlier, it had been fashionable for hip East Coast youth to dabble in communism. My mother mentioned attending some communist dances, not for the politics, of course, just for the dancing. I think it scared the willies out of my parents to think that someone might track their social activities, so much so that they kept their votes a secret, not only from their children, but even from each other. Subliminally, I absorbed the message that being too out about your political viewpoints was not just inappropriate, it was dangerous. I took it a step further and evolved into a committed non-voter, a 20-something who wanted nothing to do with the political arena. My legal voting age came and went without even a tremor of inclination towards a voting booth. Voting simply vindicated a sickened electoral system. Mine was a moral stance. Elections came and went without my notice until my boyfriend Ned discovered, to his shock and horror, that when it came to voting, I was still a virgin. Ned was from a world where politics ruled. He looked up to his dad as a successful and strategic Democratic Party organizer who energized timid and demoralized Democrats in those misguided districts that traditionally voted Republican. I saw his dad as Don Quixote, repeatedly running for local offices, tilting at Republican windmills, rarely winning an election. Ned's dad modeled himself and his family after his beloved Harvard roommate and sailing buddy, John Kennedy. Politics was not only in Ned's blood, it was in his heart and soul. And then he found out he was in love with a girl who didn't vote. I tried to explain, look, there's just no difference between the candidates, and to me there wasn't. They were all white guys in ties talking at each other, that's it. I couldn't imagine that having one or another in some office of positional power would ever mean anything in my life. Ned was stunned, flabbergasted. No difference. No difference. No difference between Nixon and Carter. No difference between Reagan and... As I look back on this conversation that happened so many decades ago, I honestly can't remember who the presidential candidates were. That's how far politics was off my radar. But I do remember the first whisper of doubt slip-sliding into my consciousness that perhaps there was some slight difference it all made which one of these suits held a title. I remember being a bit awed by Ned's absolute faith that voting mattered. To him, it really mattered. He actually believed that the little choices he made were significant. Sure, I could understand how optimism might come easily to Ned with his upper-class childhood of sailboats and boarding schools and great privilege. Still, I wondered how my everyday life might be different if I, too, assumed that my choices mattered. By the time the next November rolled around, I had come to realize that although deciding not to vote might be an act of courage for someone else, for me, it was like casting a ballot inside my own heart and mind in favor of timidity and cynicism, which wasn't how I wanted to live. So from the empty space of my doubt, I reached out and borrowed some optimism from Ned, who's now my husband. I tried on his belief in voting as an expression of possibility, and I walked myself into a voting booth. Although I never confessed it to a soul until right this moment, when I filled in that little black dot on the ballot page, I did feel something akin to hope, a vulnerable, ripply tingle of promise that this isolated little gesture might just have some impact, perhaps on this world, but surely on how I walk in this world.
Wendy Morris is a coordinator for the Institute for Community Cultural Development in Minneapolis. When people like Wendy say, as she did, that they want nothing to do with the political arena, they may be nudged in that direction by these seemingly ubiquitous voices of the election season.
Another scandal in Washington, and our congressman, Tom Reynolds, is right in the middle. A Florida congressman resigns over inappropriate contact with teenage boys. Reynolds knew of the problem months ago, but he failed to act.
On November 7th, vote for candidates who know it's not just how much you spend, but how you spend what you've got. Candidates who will spend smart and keep a lid on taxes.
There is art and science behind political advertising. Campaigns fret over when to go positive, when to go negative, and how to deliver ads so voters get the message without feeling like they're having a message delivered to them. It's delicate work, and those who make the ads are focused on how to get the most bang for their 30 or 60 seconds. To learn more about that, and maybe have a little fun, I hope, we have the two people you just heard a moment ago, Gary Grooms and Susan Fuller, two voiceover artists in the Twin Cities who get a fair amount of work nationwide when election season rolls around. Welcome both of you to In the Loop.
Thank you, Jeff.
Glad to have you here.
Good to be here.
To some people, you know, political ads are the embodiment of false promises, mudslinging, empty slogans, you know, all that's wrong with the political process. I want to hear how you feel about that. I mean, you do this for a living.
I think that's the American way. No, I'm kidding. I have mixed feelings about it, to be quite honest with you. I believe in the message that I convey, but at the same time, I realize that I may not be elevating the level of the debate.
So do you think of yourself as just hired guns, or do you care more about it than that? Is there something more to it?
Well, I care more about it than that. I mean, yes, I am a hired gun. I make a decent living doing this. I've been doing it for 30 years. I've been doing political spots for about 8 years now. But I do stuff for Democrats. I don't do Republicans anymore.
Have you ever had to just put your foot down and say, this ad I'm not going to do? You walk into the studio.
Well, no. You don't walk into the studio not knowing what you're going to be doing. For a political ad, they'll say, will you be willing to do an ad on this issue? And at that point, if you don't like where the issue's going, you can say no to it.
You both have been in this business for a while. Have you seen it change? Have you seen the discourse, the scripts that you're being handed get rougher and rougher?
Yes.
Yeah, because I just did a spot against Tom Reynolds up in New York.
Yep.
It came out 24 hours after the Mark Foley scandal.
The other thing that's changed is that it doesn't happen very often, but some politicians are willing to take a chance with humor.
Yeah,
it's just so wonderful.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the different types of ads that you're asked to do and the voices that go with them, and maybe you can give us some samples as we go here.
Well, you have to have that kind of organ music in the background, you know. If I'm doing an ad against Sue Fuller, for example, I can say...
Jimmy, a little organ music?
A little organ music, please. Sue Fuller claims she's pro-business. She says she knows what it's like to meet a payroll. Sue should know. She runs a brothel in South St. Paul. I mean, that's
very nice.
I just made that up. And pronouncing the name of your opponent, you know, you're going to say, Sue Fuller.
Yeah. Like, just spit it out.
And then you go, Gary Grooms. Sue Fuller. Gary Grooms.
Susan, now, for women, I imagine it's a little different. You can't do that.
No,
you know, Susan Fuller. Well,
you're not asked. I'm asked to do, you know, go down there and sound threatening. But the women are often asked to do the mom voice who's confused. Or, which is a huge insult, actually. Mm-hmm. Or actually the confused older woman, which is, did you hear what I heard about Gary Grooms and you know who? Well, it's true. Vote for anyone else. And then paid for by Gary, you know.
Gary, you're also asked to do folksy a lot.
Yep.
Right? What is, especially...
I sure am. Yes, sir, Jeff.
Especially for Midwestern
By ads. Cracky, I'm asked to do folksy people.
So it's, you know, you sort of make it a friendly voice and, you know, talk about the dairy subsidies in this country have to be increased because otherwise our kids won't get their milk.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Terrible. And Susan, I know you're particularly fond of a type of ad. I don't know if we called it, kitchen table ad, or how would you...
That's actually what they're called.
What is the basic premise of the kitchen table ad?
It's a couple sitting around. They're discussing the issues over a cup of coffee. And a lot of people use that on television and the radio, especially as it gets closer to the end of the election. And they're always married.
I don't know if you two have ever done kitchen table ad together before. I thought we'd give it a shot tonight. Jimmy, keyboard player for the Smarts. We get a little sort of kitchen table music, a little light piano. There we go. That's perfect.
You know, dear, I nearly skidded off the road in that darn snowstorm on the way home.
That's terrible, Tom. Did you know that in the 4 years Tim Pawlenty has been governor, winter has actually started earlier each year?
Honey, you're kidding.
No. And the summers have gotten hotter.
Oh, goodness. It sounds like Tim Pawlenty is bringing on the apocalypse.
Uh-huh.
I mean, what's next? Plagues of locusts?
That's not funny, Tom.
Uh-huh.
No. Tim Pawlenty voted 5 times for locusts while he was a state legislator.
No kidding.
No.
Well, I remember you acted like it was the end of the world 4 years ago when I voted for Tim Pawlenty. Gee, honey, I guess it actually was.
You should have listened. You never do. Just like a man.
Nicely done. Thank you. Now, we want to try one more thing here before we let you go. I thought it might be interesting to see if we could get a couple of folks out of the audience, not political ad voicing professionals, but maybe get a little coaching, give them a few lines that they maybe can use in daily life. Can we get some, let's get some scary music here, Jimmy, a little this scary voice stuff. There we go.
That's scary.
So, first of all, we have Gabe Heller and April LaRue. Gabe and April, thank you very much for being brave souls and joining us here. Gabe, why don't you give that first line a shot, and we'll see what Gary thinks, and maybe he'll give you a little feedback.
Tim Anderson hasn't cut his lawn in 2 weeks. Call Tim Anderson. Tell him it's time to clean up his yard.
Very good.
Gary, do you like that?
I like it.
Would
I
you...
would lose the shirt, but I like it.
Hey,
it's radio. I thought no one would know.
Actually, you have a nice radio voice. Seriously.
Thank you.
Gary's just full of positive things to say.
Remember, Tim Anderson hasn't cut his lawn in 2 weeks. Call Tim Anderson. Okay. Tell him it's time to clean up his yard.
Very nice. All right. Now, April, we'll give you a shot. Little music, please.
Your mother-in-law voted 6 times in favor of moving in with us. Isn't it time someone took a stand?
You're good. I would just next time I would try. Just really sound. Can I use the word pissed?
Sure.
I can sound really pissed off.
Why not?
I mean, really bite it off like that. You know? Okay.
Our volunteers: April LaRue, Gabe Heller. Our voiceover artists: Susan Fuller and Gary Grooms. Coming to a radio or TV near you. Thanks all of you for joining us here on In the Loop. This is In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. As we heard earlier, a large number of non-voters feel, for a variety of reasons, that elections just don't touch them or their lives. Even lots of voters feel that way, I think. We wondered where those sentiments come from. What are the formative experiences that shape our political instincts? Just when do Americans first encounter voting and, perhaps, a distaste for the political system? I went looking for answers in Burnsville, Minnesota, just a few hours before votes were cast for junior high student council. Now, even if you don't remember student council elections, movies and TV are ready to remind you, like in the 1999 film just called Election.
Cast your vote for Tracy Flick next week. You won't just be voting for me.
You suck!
You'll be voting for yourself.
At Nicollet Junior High in Burnsville, reality is not quite so brutal. There are no such speeches in front of the student body, and the school has traded titles like president and vice president for a more egalitarian approach, 22 equal seats apportioned by grade level. Teachers get to pick 5 of those seats. After all, we can't entrust students completely with our sacred democratic process. Even so, there are far more students running than there are seats to fill. The basic ingredients are there for politics, American style. In the lunchroom, despite a wall covered with posters, there is a certain amount of voter apathy.
None of you guys are running? So you guys are just voters?
Yep.
Yeah.
Do you take much of an interest?
No. Not really.
No!
it doesn't really matter. I just don't think it's important to me.
Candidates like Taylor, an eighth grader, are aware much of the electorate is somewhat disengaged.
Like, your best friends really care. I think they're, like, devoted to you. If you're running, then they really support you and wear all your buttons and, like, set up posters for you and stuff.
But otherwise?
They don't really care. They're just like, oh, yeah, sure, I'll vote for you if you give me candy.
Candy? Well, it turns out campaign finances are an issue in these races. If you don't have the money to reach out to voters in the form of giving out suckers, chocolate, anything with sugar, really, then you're out of luck. Vivian, a ninth grade candidate, begrudgingly plays the game.
It disappoints me because the people who really want to run a fair campaign and want to really help with the student council, they don't win because the person who had the money passed out the candy, they got more votes.
Brent, a seventh grader and therefore new to elections here, has already learned his first political lesson.
You can never buy enough candy for anyone. They just want more and more and more. I gave out gum once, one day, but I'm not wasting money on that.
Brent would much rather focus on the issues in this campaign. He's running on a platform of shorter lunch lines. Another candidate promises to cut down on school violence. Another wants a grace period for students on sports teams to get their homework done. Their advisor says quietly that just like politicians in the real world, candidates tend to stretch a little bit beyond what a junior high student council really has the power to deliver. It turns out, though, that voters aren't talking much about the issues anyway. They're far more interested in the dirty politics, like who drew a mustache on a girl's campaign poster. Brent, in particular, has seen his campaign lose its focus in recent days.
One of my friends got in a fight with another person who was running because he was taking down my posters and stealing my buttons and stuff.
Negative campaigning. What do you think about that?
I don't like it.
Are you trying to keep your campaign positive?
Yeah, but it wasn't working very well. I had to take down a few of his posters, blow off some steam.
Now, did that make you feel good, like you were making progress in your campaign?
Yes.
In the final hours before the vote, candidates like the eighth grader, Taylor, are still trying to reach out beyond their usual constituencies.
Some people you don't normally talk to, and then you talk to them during elections, and then when it's over, you just don't really talk to them anymore.
In the end, of course, candidates have no choice but to leave things in the capable hands of the voters.
So do you guys have faith ultimately in the electorate here, that they'll sort of look at the issues and the candidates and make the responsible choice?
Not in junior high. In the real world, maybe, but not in junior high. It's a complete popularity contest.
And of course, there is no element of popularity contest in the real world. We all know that. We'll wait a little bit before we tell Vivian that's the case. I might add a little postscript to this story that's also sort of unsettlingly mirroring the real world. Kevin Silberman, who's the student council advisor at Nicolet, told me he was very excited this year about how many minority candidates were in the race. The school is now about 30% non-white, but the student council hasn't really reflected that. When the election results came in, though, just 3 of 22 seats were filled by students of color. That's about 14%. Silberman, who teaches social studies, points out that while he is disappointed, it is still a little bit better than the U.S. Senate. And from the world of kids, we'll move back into the much more mature world of adults, of course. Our house band tonight is the Smarts. You guys have a political tune for us here with the name Why Can't People Think Like Me? Their tribute to the civilized human discourse that makes us all so fond of politics.
Couldn't help overhearing what you said. Couldn't help thinking that you should be dead. Couldn't help wondering if you've lost your mind. Couldn't help giving you a peace of mind.
People like you are simply misinformed.
Misinformed.
If you keep spouting off, you should be warned.
Should be warned.
People like me are pretty slow to burn.
We're slow to burn.
But when we do, you will be quick to learn.
Why can't people think like me? I can't understand the things you've bought into. What kind of brainwashing have you been through? Repeating your same mantra in every case, ignoring the truth that's right before your face.
Can't believe that your kind can still exist.
Still exist.
Can't believe thinking like yours won't desist.
Won't desist.
When everything hits the fan, you'll change your view.
You'll change your view.
Maybe you'll see things then more like I do.
Thinking that you should be dead. Couldn't help wondering if you'd lost your mind. Couldn't help giving you a piece of mind.
Our musical interval, as usual, here on In the Loop, this time provided by The Smarts. Morris Engel on drums, Jimmy Kennedy on keys, Joe Weissman on bass, all three singing there. Their new album is in tribute to, my harmonica and I are not present on that album, but I can recommend it highly to you nonetheless. You can learn more about them at thesmartsband.com, thesmartsband.com. You're listening to In the Loop here on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. So far on the show, we've looked a little bit sideways at voting and elections. After all, tonight's show is called Voting and Its Discontents, and even enthusiastic voters have some quibbles with the way our political system works. But that makes it a good time to hear from some people who did not grow up with democracy. Would they be so quick to criticize? We have for you now Lucy and David, two people who encountered American voting, elections, and freedom only later in life.
My name is Lucy Smith. I am 73 years old, and I grew up in Poland, and I am American citizen now. I was 18, and I voted because I was proud of the fact that I could. There was vote for one and only candidate for president. It was not decision, of course, but the fact that I was allowed to participate in that circus was something important for my ego.
My name is David. I'm from Togo, and I've been living in St. Paul, Minnesota for the last 5 years. Togo has been under, you know, a military dictatorship from 1967. I can say up until now, because you still have the son of the former dictator that's running the country now. Every time that there were elections where the opposition participated, every single time they won the elections, but the power which is in control of making public the result never did actually publish the truth.
In 1968, I was married to an American, and we lived in Europe for 8 years and then decided to come here. The idea that people have of United States, that they come here for getting freedom, it means that everyone that lives in that system is told you have rights. In practice, doesn't work that way, unfortunately.
There are freedoms that are available here that are weren't in where I come from. The first one I can think of is freedom of expression. You know, you can speak your mind, you can write almost anything you want, and no fearing to be arrested, jailed, or killed. But the only difference that I would say from the perception that I had and from the reality actually is that not many people are taking advantage of this freedom, not many people are exercising these freedoms.
They take it for granted because they did not see anything else. And maybe they were not taught enough the history of how difficult it was, how many people lost their lives and freedoms, and how much they sacrificed for the right to vote.
In Togo, they just need freedom. You know, they want to speak their mind, they want to wanted to make things better, they want a better life. I mean, if you only knew how it is like to live under a dictatorship, I think you would understand.
Lucy Smith and David Takasi. Sandin Totten prepared that piece for In the Loop. The music was from Twin Cities artist Jesse Green. Clearly, many Americans do take elections for granted. This may be part of the reason. On November 7th, maybe 10% of the seats in the U.S. House of Representatives will change hands. 4 or 5 might flip in the Senate, and this is considered a big year. We can blame that on the way district lines are drawn, maybe. After all, it's usually the party in power that gets to draw them. Or maybe it's the considerable advantages that go to those already in office. Since 1998, 98% of incumbents have won their House races. From early on in the election season, the media and other prognosticators label just a small number of races contested. The rest they resign to a category called safe, as in safe for the party that's already in office and safe for the rest of us to pretty much ignore. But in almost every one of these so-called safe seats, someone is running against that conventional wisdom, shooting for an upset. We wondered why and what it's like. So we asked two of these safe seat challengers to join us on In the Loop. Wendy Wild is the Democrat, taking on 8-term Republican Congressman Jim Ramstadt in Minnesota's 3rd Congressional District. Wendy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And OBCM is the Republican, challenging 3-term Democratic Congresswoman Betty McCollum in the Minnesota 4th District. OB, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your opponents are not here tonight, and as I understand it, you will have a chance to debate them, I guess, in coming days on NPR. So we're not going to do that here. We want to try and focus this conversation a bit. Obi, I want to start with you. Given the piece that we just listened to, you grew up in Eritrea, right?
And that's right.
Under an emperor.
And that's right.
Now you're an American citizen. You're running for Congress in a seat where I think many people would see your odds of prevailing as not a whole lot different than in that situation in Africa where you grew up. Why are you doing this? Why are you in this race?
Well, the short answer is because I'm an American. And I voted here at the age of 41, and I had to fight back my tears. You know, what people say to me, the first question they ask me is, who are you running against? And I want to say publicly, I'm not running against anybody. The seat is up for election every 2 years. We're not a monarchy, we're a republic, and therefore I'm applying for it with the voters. Everybody has to earn it, even an incumbent has to earn it every 2 years, otherwise it's not a republic, otherwise it's not a democratic process.
Wendy, what do you make of this term, safe seat?
The term itself actually harms the electoral process. Why are we even having an election if we can't win? First of all, I believe that we need to challenge every incumbent in every seat across America to make sure that we have a real debate. But number two, I actually believe I have a chance at winning.
When you say it harms the process, clearly from your personal perspective, it harms your chances. How does it harm the process?
Well, it harms the process because the mass media frequently doesn't want to pay attention to these races because they don't think they're going to have as many viewers or as many listeners or as many readers because there are a couple of hot, really highly contested and maybe controversial races, and they'd rather get higher ratings or more viewers or more readers. That actually serves then to tell the public, don't pay any attention because they don't even know that the race exists. And sadly, then the incumbents think that they can go back to Congress and do whatever they want because nobody's paying any attention.
Running for office is a brutal process. Is that a fair way to describe it? I mean, like a lot of people would say, I would never want to get involved with that, even if I had a better than even chance, you know, of winning the race. Why would you throw yourself into such a difficult task, Wendy?
It's not brutal at all if you believe in what you're doing. And in fact, I believe so deeply in what I'm doing that I have given up even looking for another job while I'm doing it. I think that believing in democracy is the first step.
Today I woke up at 5 o'clock, and at 6 o'clock I was out, and I started to actually lit drop at 6:45. And I'm not complaining. I'm not looking for sympathies. It's what I love to do, and I love to bring out the message. And every day I have been energized by people. I have been blessed by people. And I hope I could be a little blessing to them too.
As you've been through this, I'm sure things have run through your minds. You know, if we changed a few things, this would be seen as a contest from the start. What could change?
Boy, I have an answer right off the bat. You know, we used to have a town square where people got together and they talked and speakers had a chance to speak. We don't have a town square anymore. What we have is mass media. If those underdog candidates don't have the opportunity to get their views out, you don't have a forum. The mass media really needs to have a lot more openness to allowing candidates to have time. And I know that people say that, well, you should buy the ads. But the truth is, where does the money come to buy those ads?
I think the news media as a whole, it's about the bottom line. It's not about the issues. It's about selling the paper or advertisement or whatever it is. I think they're doing disservice to the public because we have real issues to discuss and to debate.
Last question, and I know I'm maybe kind of putting you on the spot here. Do you feel like your own parties have left you in the cold at all? Because certainly the notion is that, you know, the parties will abandon races, stop putting money into races where they don't think they're going to win.
Well, the conventional wisdom is that they're not going to go with me, who they think I can't win. They think. I hope I surprise them. And I don't blame them for what they do, but I think that's very foolish. Very foolish. Because in the long run, it won't pay. Every seat matters. And if you don't do the grassroots, where will you end? I think it's very foolish.
As the underdog in this race, or at least seen by the underdog in this race, we had the choice of just rolling over and playing dead or showing what we're made of. Do you want to send somebody to Congress who's going to say, oh no, what are we going to do? Or who stands up and says, you're not going to forget about us. Here we are. Pay attention. Woohoo. And so we've done things in our campaign to really draw attention to it. And we're getting a great amount of excitement from the party that could be forgetting us. And we've re-energized the Democratic Party in our district. So it's been a very exciting process. There have been times that you have to struggle, but I would imagine any new campaign has to do that.
Wendy Wild is the Democratic challenger in Minnesota's 3rd Congressional District. OBCM is the Republican challenger in the 4th. Thanks, both of you, for being with us on In the Loop.
Thank you very much.
In an ideal democracy, every race would be a hard-fought battle on the issues, a debate on the direction of the country or community. But even big campaigns that do get lots of attention often seem less focused on the issues and more on discrediting an opponent. This year, that has highlighted the growing role of a certain campaign character, the tracker, who shadows opposing candidates, videotaping every speech, and looking for inconsistencies and slip-ups. Minnesota Public Radio reporter Tom Scheck tracked two trackers for us, one Democrat, one Republican.
At any campaign rally, you expect mostly to find tried and true party loyalists. Take this rally in Woodbury for Republican Senate candidate Mark Kennedy. Most of the crowd cheered Kennedy's tough-on-terror talk and recitation of conservative credentials, except for one young man, just out of college, looking intense and alone in the crowd. Kyle Potter is a Democrat who enters the belly of the opposing campaign to videotape every speech, every event. Potter is a campaign tracker who's logged thousands of miles following Mark Kennedy's campaign.
When you're at an event with like 10 Republicans, they all know who you are and they're all don't want you there, then, you know, that might be one of the worst jobs you can have in politics.
Potter says his relationship with the candidate is, well, awkward.
It's like I'm trying to date his daughter, essentially, because he will be cordial, but it's very obvious that he doesn't want me there.
While Potter tracks Mark Kennedy, his polar opposite, young Republican Ryan Flynn, tracks Democrat Amy Klobuchar's race for the Senate. These campaign trackers have one mission, to look for inconsistencies in opponents' speeches, a political misstep, or a gaffe of some sort. Ryan Flynn says folks were puzzled by his job at first.
Until, you know, a little-known senator by the name of George Allen cropped up in many people's minds.
George Allen is the incumbent senator from Virginia. His re-election seemed assured, and many considered him a potential Republican candidate for president in 08. But things started falling apart for Allen earlier this year when he singled out the tracker who worked for his opponent and made this comment while the videotape was running.
So welcome. Let's give a welcome to Makaka here. Welcome to America and the real world of Virginia.
Makaka was the word he used in referring to the tracker, who was a 20-year-old American with ancestry in India. Allen's critics jumped on the comments, saying Makaka was a racial insult. Allen says he made the word up, but apologized anyway. The issue dominated news coverage, and a race that many thought would be an easy win for Allen is now neck and neck. Flynn, who tracks Amy Klobuchar, says he doesn't consider himself a spy, but more a reality checker.
This helps voters in the sense that they get to see a different view of the candidates, one that is maybe not always polished and controlled from within their campaign.
Flynn says his biggest catch was recording Klobuchar when she mixed up the former Homeland Security director with the former FEMA director that was blamed for mishandling the response to Hurricane Katrina. Flynn posted that video on YouTube just hours after the event. For the most part, Flynn and Potter say the candidates are mostly on message and rarely stray from their talking points. Flynn can basically recite what Klobuchar is going to say after taping her dozens of times.
She'll tell you that she believes in standing up for people without fear or favor.
In my job as a chief prosecutor for Minnesota's biggest county, I've learned to do my job without fear or favor.
When she was debating Cheryl Ramstead, and Cheryl Ramstead called her a street fighter from the Iron Range.
I said thank you, because if we're going to win this race, we're going to need some street fighters from the Iron Range.
The candidates do keep on their toes when they know they are being tracked. During a union rally along the Iron Range, a boisterous speaker encouraged Amy Klobuchar to swear in her speech to fire up the union faithful. Flynn says Klobuchar simply pointed to him and didn't stray from her careful tone.
That's Minnesota Public Radio reporter Tom Scheck, who covers politics. I'm standing out in the middle of our audience here in the UBS Forum at the moment. And at this part of the show, you know, we like to try and engage our audience and talk about some of what we've heard and some of what we can learn from it. We've taken sort of a skeptical tack, it's fair to say. And my first question is going to be, why bother? Why get involved? Why is it worthwhile, despite all the things that can make people feel a little dejected about democracy?
My name's Emily. I'm living in Minneapolis, and voting is one of many, many, many things that we can do to affect change, and we need change so bad that pretty much any front possible is worth doing.
Yeah, up there.
My name is Eric. I'm from Andover, Minnesota. I think that if you don't vote, you don't have the right to complain or to be happy about what the government's doing just because you didn't take part in the process and you didn't put that person there, or you didn't try to take that person and out of the election and put the other person in.
Oh, that's provocative. If you don't vote, you don't have a right to complain. Yeah, over here.
My name is Pat Lamb. I live in the Midway Frogtown area. And this will be the third election that on election day, I put out fresh flowers, have a tablecloth on the table, and I give all the voters coffee, tea, hot chocolate, orange juice, cookies. In the afternoon, I switch over to Kool-Aid. That's what I tell the kids it is. And I tell the adults, it's punch. And that is our reward for voting that day.
And this is for the people in your neighborhood, just
for
swing by the house?
For anyone who comes in and vote. And they have to show me their sticker, I vote.
Why is it that it's so valuable to you, not just that you vote, but that other people vote?
Even with our ancestors, our mothers, our grandmothers, all I've ever known was that you vote. And I had to stop taking it so personally when people didn't vote because I wouldn't speak to them for weeks. And the last election, someone told me they were going to vote, and the ambulance came to take them out. And I said, could you please wait till he vote? And they said, Pat, let it go. But that's what I do, because it's important.
Thank you, Pat. Sure. By all means. Well, let's keep going. I think people are eager to talk about the merits of voting. Yeah, right here.
Hi, my name's Melissa, and I live in Minneapolis. And for me, I really enjoy the community aspect of voting. The last time that I voted, which wasn't a primary, I went with my fiancé. We saw people from our church. We saw our neighbors. It was a really great thing to be able to connect, especially since people are becoming more insulated and getting their news from their computer or whatever the case might be. So it goes back to that whole public square thing that was mentioned earlier for me.
Is there anybody here who really feels like they do their research? They go into the election with an open mind, say, I'm going to find out where I match up with which candidates. I'm going to go to sites, you know, like Minnesota Public Radio's site actually gets a fair amount of attention because it's very complete. I wonder sometimes how many people really go in there and dig around in it versus the number of people who just use other cues or have their mind made up to begin with. Anybody who's prides themselves on having done their research this time around and having looked into the candidates? No? Yes.
My name's Claudia. I'm from Minneapolis. And I guess it depends what your threshold for research is. I mean, I usually start by looking at the lawn signs of my neighbors and then engaging them in conversation and then reading the newspaper and then going to fundraisers, which, by the way, are free. You don't have to actually write a check. And just generally, you know, it's like some people, I think, feel about football. It's a sport. I mean, there's just any number of ways you can get a lot of fun out of this process.
Yep, over here.
My name is Barbara Horton, and I'm from the Midway area. Sometimes it's not enough information out, because I wouldn't be here tonight if one person hadn't called me, and then I invited someone. Everybody don't have emails and computers, and sometimes even with the newspaper, you miss things. So I think if we had some other ways of putting out the information, more people would participate.
Well, maybe we can play a part in that. I'm very glad to have you here. I think what I'm hearing anyway, is that there is something much deeper to voting than simply walking in and marking a box, that it has to do with credibility. You know, you're standing in the world to discuss events if you've actually let your voice be heard that way. It has to do with community, and it has to do with that sense of belonging to something, and that voting is sort of a mental gateway to so many other ways of being involved. I think we're going to have to close the conversation at this point, but thanks all of you for joining in. And we'll continue with In the Loop in just a moment. You're listening to In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. And before we close down our show tonight, as I'm sure many of you are all too aware, Minnesota Public Radio is in the middle of a fund drive at the moment. And we were thinking, you know, fundraising is one thing politicians and public radio have in common. Given that it is simultaneously election season and fund drive season, we thought maybe politicians could take a few cues from the public radio playbook.
Good afternoon. I'm Joni Davis, campaign manager of the Tom Johnson for Congress campaign. And with me is campaign treasurer Jim Jackson.
Hi, Joni. Hello, Hi. Everybody. Now, we'll return you in just a few moments to our regular schedule of C-SPAN, self-government, and political scandal. But as many of you know, every couple years we take just a little bit of time out of the legislative process to remind you just how important Congressman Tom Johnson is to your life.
And the truth is, Tom Johnson's congressional career is only made possible by people just like you, people who truly understand the value of Tom Johnson.
Indeed. Now, we know you listen to Tom Johnson. Chances are he's an essential part of your daily routine. You probably listen to him in your car when you're working around the house, right?
And if you're like me, Jim, you wake up with Congressman Johnson almost every day.
But we also know that only one in six, Joni, of you hearing us right now has actually contributed and become a member of the Johnson campaign.
That's why we need you to call in or contribute online. We've got a goal of 45 campaign contributions by the end of the hour. You hear those phones? We can do it, Jim?
Of course we can, but you have to call with your support. Now, this is very exciting. For the next 15 minutes, every contribution will be matched 100% by the National Retailers Association Political Action Committee.
Oh, wow.
Retailers, Joni, are eager to give money to Congressman Johnson, but they can't do it alone. It looks like we've got maybe 10 people on the line. I know we can do better than that.
Think about what Congressman Tom Johnson means to you. Isn't a hardworking, scandal-free congressman worth at least a dollar a day?
Well, heck, I spend more than that on a cup of coffee, I think.
He does.
Love the coffee. Now, Joni, what are some of the special thank you gifts we have for people who make campaign contributions?
Oh, well, Jim, at the $100 contribution level, we have our limited edition Congressman Johnson tote bag. Isn't that nice, Jim?
That's a collector's
Jim?
Item. A collector's item.
Yes, and it's blue. Isn't that nice?
Yes.
Yes,
he's a
blue.
Republican, but we made it blue. I don't know what we were thinking.
For $200, you'll get the new 2-CD set, Family, Faith, and Fiscal Responsibility, Congressman Tom Johnson's greatest hits. Mm. All of the unforgettable bits are on there, including the speech at the Kiwanis Club and the interview
with Wolf Blitzer.
Is
that there?
Right. It is.
That's my
favorite. There.
Oh, man.
Yeah,
I was hoping that was on there. Now, we're asking you to give whatever's comfortable for you. Any citizen, any amount. But suppose you're able to give, say, the maximum amount allowable by law, $2,100, right? You'll become a member of what we call our Circle of Leadership.
Wow.
Now, at that level, you'll get a tour of Congressman Johnson's office, and we'll submit a bill of your choice on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives.
We need to keep those phones ringing. Think about where we'd be without Tom Johnson, without high-quality legislation like House Resolution 452, making November National Soybean Grower Recognition Month.
Yes. Who else brings you Amendment 1354B, securing funds for runway repairs at Jacobstown Municipal Airfield?
No.
None of this would be possible without your support.
We want to get back to running the country. Really, we do. But we're still about 25 contributions short of this hour's goal. Let's keep those contributions coming, and remember,
any citizen, any amount. Susan Fuller came back up to help with that last sketch. Remember, you can join the Loop Network at minnesotapublicradio.org. Look for In the Loop in the programs list. And you can join us in person to brainstorm for upcoming shows. The next gathering is coming up pretty fast now. Thursday, October 26th at Cosmos Bar in downtown Minneapolis. That's inside the Grave 601 Hotel. Come by about 5:30. We'll have some appetizers ordered and ready for you. A few thank yous to our live show volunteers here, Ilona Petrovska and Ewan Kerr, for helping everything go smoothly. Research assistance for this show from Nina Thorson, KQED's Pacific Time, and David Jonas. Our engineers tonight, Kyle Weslow and Denny Hansen. Alan Frechtman is our technical producer. Sandon Totten, our assistant producer. And Michael Scholar is our executive producer. My name's Jeff Horwich. Thanks, everybody, for joining us in The Loop.